Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. If you rate professions by public accolades, being a lobbyist will not come out on top. Why is that? Some might argue that lobbyists unduly influence elected officials to support narrow rather than broad community interests. Another argument is that politicians know that if they do what lobbyists ask, they'll get big bucks for re-election from the folks the lobbyists represent. A money warp of democracy. Like many generalizations, these bear scrutiny. To help us explore them and other realities of our political system are Mona Jamison and Stuart Doggett. Both are longtime lobbyists of Montana's legislature. Mona and Stuart, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground. Mona, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Long Island, New York. My mom was a dental assistant, and my dad installed fire and burglar alarms and fixed television sets.
And where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of Wisconsin undergrad and the University of Utah Law School in Salt Lake City.
If I asked you before you left the family to go off to college, what were your core values? What would you say?
My core values growing up were to attend college. That was always the goal. Education. Politics. I was consumed with politics growing up, kept scrapbooks of a lot of the debates, including the Kennedy-Nixon one, travel, and art. And I would say I grew up with those starting at a very young age. Those are things that I aspired to learn about or was always thinking about or debating with friends that were willing to enter into a debate.
Why law school for you?
When my husband and I were traveling around Europe on our honeymoon, we were talking about what we wanted to do after we graduated college. And ironically, I talked about how much I liked the Perry Mason show. Now, I know that gives away my age, but having said that, we started talking, maybe I ought to go to law school. And there, that was the beginning.
Stuart, same initial question. Where did you grow up? What did your folks do?
I grew up in White Sulphur Springs on a cattle ranch. My parents were ranchers.
Before you went away to school, before you left White Sulphur Springs, if I asked you what your core values, your core personal values were, what would you say?
You know, I was interested in competition. I loved sports, and I loved politics. And I think I was really wanting to run and seek elective office, and I had a chance to run. Unfortunately, I wasn't successful, and I got into the profession I'm into today, which is lobbying.
Why politics? Why did that fascinate a kid growing up on a cattle ranch in rural Montana?
Part of its family background. Great-grandfather was in the legislature. Grandfather was a state senator. Dad was a county commissioner. Mom was on the school board. But I think it was when Reagan was running against President Ford that I was at an impressionable age, and I really got into watching that primary. Our family was for Ford. And not for Reagan at that one. And I remember kind of being really persuaded by that and taking a real deep interest in politics.
Other than the family association, which is quite interesting, clearly you had a positive view of politics, to be interested in it in that way. What did it mean to you? Why would you say, yeah, I'm interested in politics?
Again, it goes back to a competition thing, and it kind of ties into my love of sports, and I guess I was intrigued by someone's going to win or lose, and it started with the presidential primaries in 1976, and I saw it as one more kind of a competitive thing, and I like the where people express viewpoints, and you could kind of take a position on it. And I remember watching debates and listening to discussions and the coverage of the primaries in key states, and I kind of would track who had won in certain states, how many delegates they had. So just the competition along with the issues was real intriguing to me.
Mona, you also said you were interested in politics when you were young. Why?
I guess as I was listening to Stuart, I was thinking I was really more issue-driven. I was very into the news then, watching and reading, and I was more interested in what the different parties and different candidates were saying. I was interested in the resolution of the issues, and it just kind of started, I would say, from that point. I never thought about running for any political office, but I was an observer, a reader, and I formed opinions based upon an analysis of what I thought was legitimate. And this was while I was growing up in high school.
Okay, and let's say college years, as a young adult, how would you, looking back, describe your politics on a political spectrum?
Do you mean party?
No, sort of philosophy.
Philosophy, liberal, progressive, very, very much supportive throughout time of human rights and true liberty, and more conservative from an economic standpoint. But I think I was more driven by individual rights, civil rights, and personal liberty.
Stuart, although you emphasized the competition aspect of things and the, what I'll call sort of the fascination with the nuts and bolts of politics, what would you describe your political philosophy as a young adult?
I would say it was more moderate Republican. Again, that's kind of how I grew up. And it was interesting thinking back to Reagan, who later I did appreciate very much and support the first go-around when he lost the primaries. It was like he was too far to the right. And so I positioned myself more as a pragmatist, a moderate, I would say.
With that background, Mona, why did you get into lobbying and how?
Well, I guess it began kind of as happenstance. I was chief counsel to Governor Ted Schwinden. And while he was governor, I ended up doing a lot of mandatory veto and veto messages for his consideration after policy decisions were made. And he would send me up on certain bills to testify in his behalf. And I found that it just totally meshed with my love and engagement in certain societal issues. Then when I went into private practice, I remember I was in private practice 2 weeks and I got a call from my first client. There was a special session. Did I want to lobby? So it was from that point on, many, many moons ago, that I decided absolutely. So that has always been an integral part of my practice of law.
Many moons, I understand, generally speaking, but when did you start officially lobbying?
1986 was when I went into private practice, June 1st. I think there was a special session, June 18th.
What year? 86?
86.
Okay, if my math's right, it was almost 30 years ago. So you had significantly...
Yes, almost 30 years ago. I've been in the practice of law almost 39.
Same question, Stuart. Why did you get involved in lobbying and when?
You know, I had the good fortune to get hired by the Montana Stock Growers right out of college as their public lands coordinator. And I was hired in 1984, and one of the descriptions in the job was I'd be a lobby assistant to Mons Tagan, who was one of my mentors. He was a great guy, and I miss him to this day. He was the head of the stock growers, and I was young and ambitious, and he was methodical and logical and would tell me on occasion, we're not going to take on all these issues. We're going to pick our battles, and he gave me a lot of wisdom during the years. So 1985 was my first session, and I actually, one of the key issues is where the Montana stock growers cut a deal and was working with many other groups on the stream access bill. We had members who didn't want us to pursue the stream access law, but we had some leadership on our board that said, no, we're going to step forward and compromise and work with the Wildlife Federation and Bob Ream, the bill sponsor, and others to pass that historic legislation. And it was a real eye-opener for a young man about of early 20s. So it really was also kind of a gut check, too, because there was so much controversy with our own members. It's like, this is a super tough issue for the first session for me. But again, I was so intrigued by it, I couldn't wait till the next session.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about lobbying with two experienced lobbyists, Stuart Doggett and Mona Jamison. Let's talk about public perception of undue influence, that lobbyists represent narrow interests at the expense of broad community interests. Mona, what would you say about that?
I would say it's absolutely true. And I would say that the public perception is formed by what they read and hear in Montana and what they hear or read about the national government. And that is just, it is just the truth.
Okay, you're a lobbyist. So either you feel that representing a narrow interest is not incompatible with your broad values as a citizen, or you feel you're working with an internal conflict. Which is it for you?
I only represent issues that I am personally, morally, and ethically compatible with. I've turned down many offers to lobby with some very huge fees on issues that I just didn't agree with.
Just quickly sort of sample clients.
Well, as an example, I won't mention any specific thing, but I was given a great offer to lobby the repeal of unisex insurance. and to go back to allowing it to be based using women, various conditions, pregnancy, et cetera.
Higher rates for women.
I said that there was actually no amount that they could pay me to do that. The internal conflicts I didn't have because I was comfortable with what I was lobbying for.
What do you lobby for?
I was one of the two lobbyists with John Delano for the seatbelt law in Montana. I was the lobbyist for the acquisition of Virginia and Nevada City. I was the lobbyist to decriminalize direct entry midwifery.
Some of these things are a little technical. Direct entry into midwifery, what does that mean?
It means that I lobbied to decriminalize women going into homes to assist women having home births. That was probably the most vicious fight I ever had, even though there were only 11 direct entry midwives in the state of Montana at that time.
How interesting.
Yes. I also, in doing the acquisition of Virginia City, it was lobbying for over $6 million for the acquisition of those two very, very precious cities and historical heritage sites, you might say, of Montana. Getting that appropriation required a ton of work. And, of course, I was very, very supportive of that, had no ethical conflicts about that, because I believe that people should have a strong connection to place and landscape. And seatbelts, totally support that, still do. And even though it was a secondary offense, without that, we wouldn't have a seatbelt law.
Stuart, same question about the broad public perception and how you see that.
Well, some of it's certainly earned, and I think a lot of it comes the perception from the national perspective. And I see Jack Abramoff and some of the results that he had and just the widespread distribution of money and connections and things that were just personally unethical. And, of course, they get ramped up on a national media, and people from around the nation but also in Montana see that, and they identify lobbyists in that perspective, not everyone. When I talk to groups, I let them know that when I'm in the halls of legislature, I see a lot of ranch kids like myself, and I see women and men from business communities or from small towns that they have a passion for politics and they want to make a difference, like Mona and I try to do in our professions. And just a lot of good people from Montana are lobbyists. And it's really not this shiny suits in the halls of the Montana legislature. And I think that perspective is, like I say, more at a national level. It comes to the negative, but it certainly does exist.
You raised the issue of Jack Abramoff and big bucks in campaigns, and obviously that's the case for national elections. Montana has very strict campaign limits in terms of spending for legislative races. We're a small state population-wise, and as you point out, it's sort of a different scale. What's your sense in Montana now, specifically in the legislature? Does money have a big impact in terms of the flow of dollars to candidates, or would you say not, or what?
I think it has an impact on a couple levels. It certainly does in elections. And those that are incumbents certainly are going to see PACs and political groups want to support them because they know their voting record and their trends. So that's going to benefit both sides of the aisle. But yes, I think it is on a smaller scale here because of our limits, and just it's not like it is on the national level with super PACs, etc. On the other hand, it's just like you watch the Water Compact issue. They're running some very excellent ads, their imagery. So I think we are seeing that. At least I'm sensing more of that in the last 10 years, that money still does matter. Maybe it's not directly to a person's campaign, but we're seeing some indirect and other distributions where they're urging the public to get involved and contact legislators. So we're seeing money on those levels influence the political effort here in Helena.
I would disagree with Stu to a certain extent. I think money still has a massive influence on Montana politics. The only difference to me between here and the national level is the amount of money, but the impacts, the plays, the games, to me are the same. And what you see is what people don't see, but when you're in the game, what you see is the bundling of contributions. You see lobbyists buying favor with various legislators. You find legislators looking at lobbyists sitting in the audience trying to get the direction on some of the bills. You see lobbyists and legislators at restaurants. You see them on golf courses. Now, I've done that. I've done the restaurant thing. And it's important because it's access. What the money buys, the lobbying, is not the result. It's first the access. In some cases, at certain levels, it is the ultimate decision. And I've often commented that if the people understood and saw what was really going on, if they saw the power and the influence of lobbyists and of contributions, I think they would be grossed out, and I think that this would apply to both ends of the political spectrum. I think the issue of money is what has been driving this. For example, personally, I believe in public financing of campaigns. I believe that if we had public financing of campaigns, we would see what true public policy really is. We do not see that because it's the interests that drive the results.
Mona said she partially disagreed. That sounded like a pretty strong partial disagreement. How do you see that, Stuart?
My good friend Mona makes some great points. I mean, I do agree with her comments that, yes, some access is certainly given, and even though it's not widely stated, it does. But I still, again, I make the comparison what I think is the criticism or concept or about lobbyists on the national perspective related to the Montana lobbyists. I think it's a real different group, in my opinion. I'm real proud to be a lobbyist in the Montana legislature, and I really enjoy the profession. And I see some people I greatly respect in the halls of the legislature, you know, trying to make a difference for the people they represent. I also see some things that I certainly don't like and have questions about, but I'm an optimist. I try to put those aside and move forward with my own issues.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about lobbying with two experienced lobbyists, Stuart Doggett and Mona Jamison. Let's talk about the other political realities of the Montana legislature. I came here 26 years ago from California, where the legislature's full-time. Here it's part-time, convening every 2 years for how many days?
90 days.
90 days. My sense from having some background in California politics was this is kind of like a madhouse in terms of crunch, for one thing. And the implication of that to me was so much is happening so fast, people don't have a lot of time for thoughtful deliberation. Would you agree or disagree with me on that?
I would agree. And I would like to see some form of annual sessions. And I know that's not popular with the public. But for my 30 years as a lobbyist at the Montana legislature, I like the sounds of what I hear, I believe, from Wyoming, where they meet for like a 30 or 60-day and then another time for a 60-day session. And one of the sessions 1 year is on budget, and then the other session the next year is on more general issues. That makes sense to me because, you know, we have an extremely large budget, even though we're a rural state. And you're right. Sometimes things do get rushed.
There's a benefit to having a 90-day session. It forces people to work, and it results in less money and the influence of money affecting the decisions. The problem is with the short session, 45 days before transmittal of general bills, legislators are not given the opportunity to really delve into and develop a history and a knowledge base of a particular subject. So there are benefits and there are not benefits to the 90-day session. I think maybe 120 days would be a little bit more reasonable, because the first 2 weeks of a session is getting to know you, and then you do have a mad rush. My problem is really with the term limits. The lack of knowledge that the legislature has demonstrated as we get further and further away from term limits when they were adopted is, I think, unacceptable. When you have a legislator, won the session, I would never mention the name, wondered why his bill that passed the House, why it even had to go to the second chamber of the Senate. Excuse me? That is basic governance. That is more of a problem, the term limits, to me, than the crunch of the 90 days.
Well, I was one of those that opposed and voted against term limits, and I still think it continues to be create the situation that Mona's mentioned and some others became aware of. Just the inexperience, you have people, men and women, that really want to serve, and they're willing and they're capable. But again, there's so much new information for them, and their first couple of sessions is a great learning curve. And so it's unfortunate with term limits. that after four sessions in the House and they're termed out, or after two terms in the Senate, they're termed out. And it's unfortunate because we lose a lot of experience and that continuity from one session to the next. The other thing is, there's a sense that I have, and I felt it this session too, you have some people that are just looking for a two-year situation. Legislators, it's like, we got to get the House Bill 2 passed, which is always has to get done, but they tend to look at issues and things just in a two-year perspective rather than looking more long-term. And I have a sense that in the past, some legislators, the older ones that had been there for years, were looking, well, what's this really going to do 10 years down the road? And I think there was some longer looks ahead, and I feel now with term limits, you're shortening people's time in office, but also their viewpoints. They're not looking ahead.
The benefit of the part-time legislature is that it is truly the citizens' legislature. When you have a full-time legislature, like California,
yep,
or Congress, they are professional jobs. And I believe that the driving forces are different. So I think the debate is, how do you have a true people's forum and give them the opportunity to learn and to develop the knowledge base? And I think that would be an interesting issue to explore, maybe beyond just the term limit issue, is making a session 6 months. Would that counterbalance some of it? But you win and you lose knowledge with the citizen legislature. But the one benefit you have with that, and we'll get into term limits you mentioned in a minute, I think there's a benefit, but we need to find a way to provide these legislators, these people, with a way of gaining knowledge.
Mona's arguing, Stuart, we have a citizen legislature. I would argue that the citizens often are not fully informed. They're busy. We're not a political society. So just to bring, and there's a lot of data that will support that statement, that in a lot of cases the public does not know. Let's say you mentioned the Water Compact, Stuart. That's complicated stuff. So if we have a problem, what might we do to fix it, to enhance the knowledge level of the legislators above the average citizen? After all, that's why I vote for somebody, to represent the public interest and to get the facts.
Well, I'd like to see term limits eliminated, especially in the legislative end, but I don't think that's going to happen. I've seen polling where Montanans are about 60% plus wanting term limits. I would like to see maybe be modified. Instead of 8 years in either the House or Senate, maybe they would bump that up to 12. It would be somewhat of a compromise. I think that way you would see men and women being chairs of committees that maybe had three or four sessions under their belts. I see some great people that they're thrown in to be a chair of a committee, tax, business, whatever. These are major committees, and it's their second session at the legislature. They do a good job, but, I think they would probably have to agree, some of them, that they might have benefited from another session of watching it and maybe experience involvement in other committees. So I think expanding the amount of years for term limits is something that should be looked at.
Mona, what do you think? You mentioned the possibility of longer sessions. Any other ideas?
Well, I don't think that we're going to get the legislature or the people to vote through an initiative to extend or change the term limits. I think we are going to live with them forever. There have been attempts in the legislature the past number of sessions to change this. The bills die, and I think there had even been one or two times the people actually vote on it through an initiative, and it failed. I think then the message we have to take from that is we have to find another way of providing a method for legislators to get more knowledge. That's why I was thinking, well, how can we do this since we know we're never going to get a change in term limits? Well, change it from 90 days to 120 or 180. Yeah. Maybe people would then accept, okay, we still have term limits, but we're going to give it a little bit more time. Now, that would require a constitutional change. I don't know if that is even possible to happen, but I know that what would be working against it is, oh, we're going to pay more money for those people to go up there and wrangle, and you read everything in the newspaper. So I'm not even sure that's a possibility. I think we may have boxed ourselves in to the situation that we have right now.
You mentioned wrangling, and certainly this last session had its share of inflammatory rhetoric picked up by the press. I talk with a fair diversity of people, and people just shake their heads. What's your sense? You've been lobbying for almost 30 years, Mona, is this the way it's always been? Has politics changed? What's going on?
This is not the way it's always been, and this is what's sad. It used to be, prior to term limits, there were collegial relationships between legislators of both parties. There was compromise. Yes, people would get angry, but they'd sit down, they'd hammer issues out, there would be resolution. Because of the term limits, what we've developed is such partisanship. And I think there are many other things that go into this that we don't have time to discuss. But part of the wrangling this time was because of issues that were dividing the Republican Party. So you had a lot of internal wrangling in that party. And the irony is the governor ended up getting some major pieces of legislation because of coalitions that were formed between some of the moderate Republicans and the Democrats. The wrangling, though, is not the way it used to be. And I actually have said, for the new lobbyists and legislators practicing recently or lobbying or legislating recently, they have no idea how it could be, because what they've seen is not the best way, and it isn't the way that it was.
Stuart, do you agree that it hasn't always been that way? And if so, what do you think the causes are and what might be done to fix it?
I do agree that there's a different tenor than the first few sessions when we didn't have, again, term limits. And I think back to an analogy that Gene Turnage told me when I was helping run his campaign. He also knew that in the sessions I was a lobbyist. And he said, young man, he said, you know, if you have a chance to take down your opponent or you're on the winning side, make sure to give them a small ledge to stand on. And I kind of got it then. And I think as time's gone forward, I appreciate that comment, because there was a sense of what Mona said on both sides, that, yeah, one party or the other might be in control, but they would often give their opponents a little bit of a ledge or some courtesy. I do see some courtesy extended now, but I do agree that there's more tensions that's there.
Okay, in a nutshell, is there anything that can be done about it, or does that just reflect political reality in Montana?
Again, we need to look at term limits and extending the time that people could be there, because two things. People could serve longer, but also you might see some people be in leadership that would have more than one session in the leadership position. Because with term limits, we're basically turning over new leaders every session as well.
I wish we could discuss this issue further, but I very much regret to say we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.